Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Masters of Our Domain. It's the podcast that was once about the hit 90s sitcom Seinfeld and is now about temporarily barbarians, but also about anything we want to talk about. I am Milo Edwards, and I am joined for the first time in a while by both of my esteemed co-hosts, Phoebe Roy and Patrick Wyman. How are we doing?
I'm floored by you saying ladies and gentlemen, so I'm going to need a few minutes to recover from that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you keep that up. Bruce Buffer will have some competition as a ring announcer.
Mm.
Living the dream. Absolutely living the dream. Very excited to talk about this episode of television, which I quite enjoyed.
Mm. It was a good one. It was quite action packed.
It was action packed.
I sort of didn't think it would be this action packed.
It's also the last one of the series. I feel like
What's going to happen in season two? They've done it all.
No, covered it all. They've really covered it quite comprehensively. It's just, I think it's just such a long time since I've seen a properly edited TV series that it kind of having a proper pace and then finishing with its like climax in the last episode is just like, oh. I don't know what just happened here. Because, you know, there's this new thing. I say new thing. There's
this new thing. They're calling it Netflix. Have you heard about this Netflix?
Oh, yeah. They mail you DVDs in the post.
They mail you DVDs through the post. And then the thing is that you get if you don't rewind the DVD, you get charged. You get charged like 50 quid.
What so Netflix? You mean a Retarius?
It's a poor model. Netflix. What you mean? No, I've got nothing. I was going to say something.
Just want to watch Netflix, and they don't respect the man who flicks the net.
This is something you're not allowed to do in tennis. I don't know.
I mean, I do like the Retiarius line of reasoning. I think we could push that further if we wanted to mine that particular vein.
This is a specific homophobic description of a tennis player. Okay, Netflixer.
Yeah. What? Blockbuster? You mean a stonemason?
We can tell that this was a site of great ritual significance by the blue and the yellow around the temple doors.
That's right.
For our younger listeners, that was the colorway of Blockbuster.
Yeah.
Oh, I loved Blockbuster video so much. Yeah, so many of my formative memories took place in a Blockbuster video. Honest to God, so many pieces of this is my most kind of older millennial trait, is that so much of my personality is assembled from movies that I rented at Blockbuster Video. It's just undeniably a true fact.
Yeah. On multiple occasions when I was small, my parents, and I don't remember what the occasion was that caused this, but my parents would leave me, not with my sister, but with her like Guido Italian Essex boyfriend. And we would go to Blockbuster and rent something like Assault on Precinct 13 and eat a Domino's. What times? Great times.
But see, aside from the presence of a Guido, I had much the same experience.
Yeah.
That was like, I too have rented a slightly age inappropriate action movie, eaten Domino's, and had that be the evening.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, but what does a 10-year-old boy need more than to see Ethan Hawke stab someone through the eye with an icicle? You know?
I mean,
is that what happens in Assault on Precinct 13?
It's one of one many, of many things, things that happens in that movie. It's an absolutely insane film.
It is.
Oh God, add it to the movie list.
Yeah. There's a lot
Ethan,
to love
Ethan
about
Hawke,
that.
Ethan Hawke, he's an eagle. He lives over there.
Yeah, he's got a nest. His first role was torturing Prometheus.
He's currently in a rights dispute with Netflix's show Chaos about being credited there.
Yeah. It was actually Eating Hawk, and they changed it at Ellis Island.
He's also in a image rights dispute with with Varys's legions because they used his likeness for their standard without permission.
It raises important questions of intellectual property law.
It does, yeah. It really does. Yeah, so this new thing that I've noticed over the last 10-15 years is that not only when you start watching a show, you assume that the first three episodes are going to be like meandering bullshit, and everyone you speak to says, no, you got to leave it a minute. You got to let it warm up. Like, it doesn't get really good until season two. And you're like, okay, you know what? First of all, I think it's very cute that you think I'm going to live forever. But
Fighting talk from someone who started a Seinfeld podcast 4 years ago.
Yes, I know. Okay, fine. That's true because you need to start at season three. That's true. But that's, I think it's different for a sitcom. First of all, seasons one and two are very, very short and the episodes are 20 minutes. But like, if it's like some kind of ponderous drama, which is really like, you know, badly lit, and there are lots of, you know, there are lots of guys and they got names and you've got to learn the names and you've got to learn the relationships. I know I am describing what watching a TV show from first principles is. I'm aware of that. I know I'm describing it like how you would describe it to an alien. That's fine. But I don't really have the time to be fucking around with a TV show that's not immediately interesting. Like, not immediately funny. Got to find its feet. Got to warm up a bit. Fine. Not immediately, okay, I can spend some time with this TV show. I haven't got time for it. So this one really kind of, it really hit the ground running. And they also didn't do this thing, which I find particularly maddening, which is when they have the climactic event in the penultimate episode. And then they have this weird kind of stump episode at the end where everyone's just like dicking about, saying how they feel about what was the ending of the show. I hate that.
The longer that stretch of time is, the more uncomfortably meta these things are. And it's a trick that some writers use to, because it makes them feel clever, like that they are deconstructing the meaning of their work at the end. Like, the longer that goes, like, but if you can't, so the whatever the post climax is in a structural sense in any thing like this, the point of it is to tie up the very last ends of the story and to kind of like cement home whatever your major thematic drivers are, and the longer that goes on, the worse you are at it. That you shouldn't need an entire episode to hammer home the meaning after whatever the climax is. Like, even in shows like Game of Thrones, like, they still had kind of a secondary climactic point in that episode they did rather more interesting things with structure than
it's
that.
It's the TV, like, equivalent of like saying goodbye to somebody after an evening out. And it's a really nice, warm goodbye. And then you bump into each other at the bus stop and it's the worst thing that's ever happened to you.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't need that. Nobody needs that.
No one needs the double goodbye.
And it kind of took us by, I think it took me by surprise too, how well-paced this was, where you're like, you can just do it in 6 42-minute episodes. Like, there's absolutely, just, like,
is
edit
that,
it ruthlessly. Yeah.
They're doing the battle. They're doing the battle now. It's episode six. Like all the kind of tying up the loose ends epilogue thing. I accept what you're saying, Pat. I know it is to indicate that that the very concept of narrative structure is an artificial one, and they want to make you think that the characters represented go on living outside the boundaries of the story. Fine. Yeah. All it makes me do is think, oh, autoplay has popped me onto season two.
I absolutely hate that tendency. it drives me batshit insane. Like,
I've still not seen the last episode of One Day because they do the big horrible climax in the penultimate episode, and I watched this thing in a kind of, you know, in a sort of block, and when the penultimate episode finished, I was like, I kind of hollered for George to come in the room. I was like, what's just happened? I should know what's just happened in this TV show that I've dedicated some time to watching. Mm. And he said, yeah, everyone knows that. Have you not read One Day? And I was like, no, I haven't. Clearly, because this has come as a great unpleasant shock to me. And now there's another episode. So yeah. what's going to happen in the other episode?
I have read it, but I forget every book that I read. So I retain vague concepts of what happens in them. But then, like, when I see a TV remake of them, I'm like, oh, I forgot that.
That's a really interesting skill. It's like being a kind of reverse necromancer.
Well, I do magic that kills people.
No, you do magic that, like, oh, you know what? It doesn't matter. It's very early in the morning here. Like, I'm not firing on all cylinders.
I feel like you're suspended somewhere between a dream state and full consciousness. Like, you're in a really, you're in an interesting spot right now, Phoebe. Like, yeah, you're kind of dancing on the astral plane.
Yeah, yeah. Phoebe's the Sybil. She's in a room filled with noxious volcanic gases.
Yeah,
we're communing with the Phoebe to divine the will of the gods.
Yeah, I've been inhaling the fumes. I've been instructing people to go and stand by the canal and just hit golf balls into it.
Yeah. The irony that me and Patrick are both vaping and you're the one who's inhaling the vapors, truly.
That's true. It's a kind of spiritual vaping. Like, you vape and it comes through to me through the airwaves across the time zones.
Yeah. Guy going to see the Sybil and he's like, can I have a hit on that?
Yeah, I mean,
you can't twos the Sybil.
Is that cherry and pomegranate?
Twos.
Yeah.
So this is something I wonder about, is because in all ancient societies, people had ways of getting fucked up. And booze is the one that is best attested, but there were many other ways of entering an altered state in the ancient world. And like everything from kind of like self-mutilation to things derived from poppies to cannabis to there are also people there's evidence of eating psychoactive mushrooms. Like, people have always been like experimenting and pushing the bounds of consciousness. That's something that occurred to me very strongly in this episode, and it was something I really liked about it, is that it really takes you into this weird spot where the characters are doing things that are objectively insane, but they make perfect sense given the way that they've established them, the kind of world that they've built up. It makes perfect sense that this woman cuts her eye out and dedicates that to the gods in return for foreknowledge of this battle. Like, you can see how she's talked herself into that. Like, they've taken us on the journey where her actions make sense, even though they're objectively nuts.
Yeah,
it's very funny when Arminius sees her, like, obviously quite horrifying facial injury, and she just goes like, I'm fine, in the most dad-coded way of all time. Like, man, he's clearly really injured and needs to go to hospital. Yeah, I'm fine, don't worry about it.
It's just a scratch. It's farmer who has mangled his hand while putting a fence post in. It's that. That's the energy.
R.I.P. to Snilda. You'd have loved the Midwest.
I mean, okay, but that is the Midwest, man. It's this kind of like broadly Germanic stoicism. In a kind of a lightly forested setting.
That's and Italians aren't welcome.
Again, broadly true. Like, you've just described most of the upper Midwest, I think. Like, you can see, am I talking myself into the worldview of 19th century German romanticism right now? I feel like I kind of am.
potentially you are.
Maybe.
I also really like the idea of like there being like this one ancient guy who never has his own mind altering substance, but always wants to get in on other people's because he's only having a bit. This guy, the one guy who like shows up at Delphi is like, oh no, I'm not putting in, like I'm not doing anything, but can I just like, can I have a dab, just like a dab, like Roman, I don't need my own. No, I'm fine, guys, I'm fine. We know. I'll give you like a pound.
I don't do silphium anymore unless anyone's got any.
So the Scythians, the Herodotus describes a practice that can only be described as hotboxing among the Scythians. So basically they would get a wagon and they would cover it and they would put a brazier in it, and then they would just drop weed onto it, and they would just sit in the wagon and breathe in the fumes. And so Herodotus describes this in great detail as a Scythian practice. And so, yeah, the Scythians did just invent hotboxing. Like, there's nothing new under the sun. I wonder.
R.I.P. Scythia, you would have loved the Joe Rogan Experience.
R.I.P. Scythia, you would have loved the music of Sublime.
Okay, so would you guys like to know some interesting new research on the Scythians?
Absolutely.
Anytime.
What I love about you, Pat, there are so many things I love about you, but the number one thing is there are so many ways that that sentence could have ended, and it's basically unpredictable. It could have been about Scythians, it could have been about hotboxing, it could have been about the music of the band Sublime. We just don't know.
A guy you met on a building site once, which is relevant somehow. It could be anything.
I mean, I'd like to think we're all just going on a verbal adventure here. Yeah, so interesting new research on
the... We are truly the modern polymath. That is what your garden variety podcaster is. We're the enlightenment guys. We're sitting there amongst our Palladian architecture. We've just got all of this just like stuff, just like kind of crammed onto shelves. It's not related to each other, but sometimes we like to pick it up and admire it.
People think of the Scythians as having invented the scythe, but the thing is, they also invented hotboxing, and no one ever talks about that.
And really, in the grand historical schema, which of those is more important?
Yeah,
they also invented the short form comedy sketch.
A bunch of guys at a Honda Civic in Indianapolis in 1999, unaware that they're participating in an ancient Scythian ritual.
To be quite honest with you, I think there's something beautiful in that. I love thinking about, I don't know why this has been on my mind so much lately, but I have been thinking about these small acts that people have been doing in some form or another for so very long. Like when you mentioned when we were recording last time, Milo, your experience with the Latin tutor, slamming shut the giant book and reprimanding you for a faux pas. Like again, that is you connected down through the ages to generations of students. Like
Alexander the Great had the same experience approximately at some point.
Yeah. Like all of these, like, and I think there's something beautiful in that. I think they're just as I think there's something beautiful in I have hotboxed a 1990 Honda Civic, and it was a quasi religious experience for me. And now that I know the ancient Scythians did that, I feel connected to them as well.
Yeah, the ancient Scythians would be like, this vehicle is amazing. It has a built in brazier. You just press a button and it's heated by some kind of magical coil.
It's like one of the old school like cigarette lighters that you would push in.
God, I miss cars having those. They were so. I used to have an old car, and I once lit one of my mate's cigarettes with that, and they were like, "That is fucking sick." And I was like, "The old ways, brother. The old ways."
It is. Oh, god damn it! Yeah.
I'm a statue guy, but just for having cigarette lighters in cars.
It's because they didn't have a lighter, and I was getting in my car saying goodbye to them, and I was like, "Oh, I don't have a lighter," and I was like, "Wait, I do." And I turned my fucking car on, and I heated the thing up, and I lit their cigarette out the window with it, and then drove off. It was beautiful.
And then you saw the future.
Time is
sorry,
a flat
Pat,
circle.
We massively interrupted you. Please tell us about this new research about the Scythians.
No, this is look. This is the structure of what we do here. Okay, new research on the Scythians. So we tend to think of the Scythians as being steppe nomads, right? Like, so there are people who move around with their flocks and their herds, and they've got their horses and they live in wagons. So it turns out that only the Scythian elite did that. Most of the people who lived in this area were settled farmers who probably spoke a different language and who were essentially the tributary population for these Scythian like warlords and their war bands. But these guys were basically cosplaying as being steppe nomads in a very restricted range that they maintained like a preserve for themselves.
So they were like on like permanent gap year.
Yes. And they're like, we're just going to hang out here and do this. We'll have people like they had people to do the herding.
Kids in Goa.
Yes, they had people to do the herding for them so they could just ride around on horses and shoot bows and arrows and like, you know, get the boys together to do some light raiding in the summer. And so they built this lifestyle for themselves based on exploiting these tributary populations and so that they could cosplay as being like brave steppe warriors.
This is like if for years the only evidence of British culture that existed was the tossing the pill about with Chugsy video. And then and then like suddenly a recording of The Only Way is Essex emerged and, you know, the archaeologists were forced to completely reevaluate what was going on in British society at the time.
That's so interesting. I'm trying to think of something. Obviously, I'm talking to Pat Mar.
I appreciated the aside, but we can also keep talking about the research.
I'm also learned, but of a very different
thing. Very specific way.
Look, these are complementary skill sets. That's the whole. These are complementary skill sets. Mm. They mesh together nicely. No one person can be all things.
We're on a quest to consult the Milo.
I do like the idea of each of us being like separate odd oracles surrounded by our own different fumes, sitting in our own particular caves, dispensing cryptic statements.
Sitting in our own specific clouds.
Yeah.
Our own specific hallucinogenic clouds. My specific hallucinogenic cloud is like demanding that I try and think of like a way into making a joke about a Scythian exercise class, which is called like step aerobics, but it's
the Scythian leotard made of like animal hide.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the thing is,
and then, like, but it's done in like a really like kind of dark room with like kind of mists, and then there's a kind of shaven headed step priest at the front, like yelling, "Everyone up in their seats! Do you want it?"
Gideon, Mr. Motivator.
Yeah, that in
Scythian
the
soul
case,
cycle. There we go.
He would be wearing like a belt of human scalps, like. They were the Scythians. I'm fascinated by this because like they built this lifestyle for themselves that was so clearly based on like cruelty and exploitation. A lot of it was like a lot of what they did, kind of their bread and butter economic activity, was slave trading and raiding for slaves. So like this is like a predatory class of people who admittedly were kind of baller in that they made this work for themselves for many centuries. Like they were really good at doing this. But it was like just a god awful way of life that was based around immiserating huge numbers of other people to fund their particular like cosplay.
Mm. And also very, very, their exercise classes, very, very popular amongst the glamour milfs. Yeah. And it's something that you can add to my program of ancient world exercise classes, alongside Pontius Pilates.
You do not want to get cross with him.
No, you don't. Have you ever been to a Pontius Pilates reformer class? Fucking hell.
Oh my god. Brutal.
You look amazing afterwards, but take disinfectant and cotton gauze with you.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you could get a nasty infection.
I am fascinated by the phenomenon of jacked Jesus. This is you can watch this happen like in depictions of Jesus and kind of like American evangelical culture. I feel like he's getting increasingly jacked It's like Marvel movie inflation of the figure of Jesus. And that tells you something, I think, pretty fundamental about where these people's heads are at.
If Kumail Nanjiani, Jesus.
But yeah. Oh, no, way too brown, man. Way too brown. He bulked
for our gains.
No. Everybody in this particular set knows that Jesus was white. Thank you.
Yeah.
The creator on the creatine, etc.
Yeah, beautiful.
Well, look. Are you trying to tell me that that the Lord would not be on anabolic steroids?
He specifically trenbolone. That's the one that Hugh Jackman is always on for, or reported to be on when he plays Wolverine. That makes his traps blow up and look all veiny and shit.
Is that also what turns his bones into metal?
No, that's a separate substance.
Very funny to be like on steroids and also have a name which is essentially Huge Jacked Man.
Yeah, I know. I was literally just thinking like, what? Like, that's lovely nominative determinism. I'm just trying to think if it would be funnier if Hugh Jackman is his kind of late stage name. And his real name is like Teeny Skinny Guy.
Yeah. Tim Weedman or something.
Tim Weedman.
Yeah. So, I wanted to talk about with this episode. This comes back to the stuff that talking about earlier. I promise. I'll get it back there. I appreciated it's good structurally sound storytelling. That moved at a reasonable ass pace. Thank you. This show knows that we don't have 10 60-minute episodes here. Like, we don't have 600 minutes. You can make a really great show in 240 minutes if you edit it ruthlessly. And that's exactly what they did here. There's very few extraneous scenes that don't move one of the major plots forward. Like, they didn't fuck around with a lot of pointless subplots. It was pretty ruthlessly focused on the A, B, and C plots as it went through. I loved that about it. And it didn't make it any less vivid. It's not like it felt like there was something missing from the way this set up the world that more exposition would have helped. It did exactly what it needed to. It's just a really, really well-crafted piece of television.
Yeah. I think there are one or two things which felt a little extraneous, which felt a little bit setting up for the hope of having a second series, which the issue is if you make a TV show about a specific historical event, but you also want to be recommissioned, do you keep your powder dry and hope that you get a second series, or do you tie it all up in the first one and hope that you can come up with something which kind of departs from the historical record for season two? So there are one or two things which are which felt slightly kind of, oh, we're going to come back to this, like the hot slave girl who Foquin pals up with in the Roman slave market. Like, she's not really a kind of sort of valuable load bearing plot girly. She's more of a kind of extraneous girly. She's more of a surplus girly. She's more of a time of economic stability. So we have surplus girlies.
Well, when you have surplus girly, it can cause sort of price problems in the girly market, and also you might find yourself in some kind of trading deficit with other girly producers.
Oh yeah, no. I mean,
what's the girly tariff situation?
I mean, Keynes failed to predict what happens when you're in a surplus of girlies.
Yeah. Well, he thought that girlies would be more evenly distributed and so people would need to work less. But actually, the abundance of girlies has only led to people working more.
Well, this is the issue with trickle down girlies. actually doesn't bear out.
They in fact do not trickle down.
They do. No, the girlies do not trickle.
She's such a trickle down girly. Always try to impress the economists.
The upper class hoard the girlies. No one is trickling. The girlies are not being paid back into the economy. Anyway, so that sort of doesn't really. There's a bit that happens at the end, which is a little bit of a callback, which obviously we will get to, which isn't sort of particularly in service to the kind of, you know, the meat of the plot, the musculature. There's like a little, there's some fast twitch muscle fibers being activated in this episode, but not many. We're mainly working on the hamstrings and the glutes of the episode. That's what you do at Pontius Pilates. It's very hamstring focused.
As it should be. The posterior chain is extraordinarily important.
Yeah.
If you want to, you know, for maintaining posture, keeping your lower back healthy. Yeah. Very important stuff.
You've got to be very careful though. When you go in that room, there are going to be two sets of machines. One of them you get on, the other one you do not get on. You do not get on that machine in the corner.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay, so
if they give you something to sign, don't sign it.
I've probably signed my soul away on gym waivers. At some point in my life, I'm sure I signed the wrong thing, and like my soul is destined for an eternity in hell.
Yeah. You signed a confession going in, a sort of trumped up confession.
Yeah, probably. Like
it would be hilarious. This is my trumped up confession. Okay, they said I'll never confess, but I will. They said he can't confess, but look at me now. They didn't believe me. They indicted me, and I confessed. Anyway.
Oh my God! Oh, I can't. I can't with Donald Trump. I can't. It's that this moment is absolutely killing me. I just. What a time to be alive.
Body pump with Trump. There's the other exercise class.
Yeah, it's one of the truly one of the most hilarious things about him is that he believes that exercise drains your energy.
Mm.
That sounds about right.
Imagine being, imagine being a person who believes that you have a limited store of energy and that if you spend it on exercise, it will like imagine that worldview. Imagine the kind of person you have to be to believe something like that.
R.I.P. pre-Socratic philosophy. You would have loved Donald Trump.
I would like to imagine a run-in between Donald Trump and Diogenes the Cynic. The guy's just fucking sitting there wearing a barrel, shitting in the street, talking shit about whatever he sees.
Very, very sad guy lives in a barrel. Okay.
And Trump's just like, what are you doing for snacks?
Yeah.
What are you doing for snacks in that barrel? I don't think I'd like to go in the barrel because it feels like there are no snacks.
Trump would think the guy was a loser for jacking himself off rather than like having a guy for that.
That's how you know you've truly made it. Like, that's really the essence of success in life is when you have a person to jack you off.
Exactly.
I mean,
trickle down economics.
That accurately describes the aspirations of male elites throughout much of history is to find someone else. Is like the increasingly globalized search for finding new people to jack you off.
Well, I mean, you know, say what you like about the decadence of the late Romans. They really had like optimized that process to a kind of rigorous efficiency. Like you've just got different rooms for the different stuff. It's just all in the same building.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you could view the entire Roman Empire as an increasingly elaborate series of institutions designed to find new and interesting ways to jack off elite Romans.
Mm.
Like what is colonial? What is empire, but a search for increasingly elaborate ways to jerk off for a select group of people at the top?
Well, yeah, well, and this is why the British Empire was so revolutionary, because the British army went all over the world, but they were mostly just jacking each other off, something which they could have done at home.
Irony of ironies.
Keeping it in house.
Look, I don't understand why we're in India. We've got jacking each other off at home. You just need to go back to school.
The British Army's mum.
We've got
spices at home, and it's just like mint.
I mean. Okay, I'm going to return to the search for places to jerk off as new places to jerk off as a defining force in human migration.
We don't need hands.
Okay, I can imagine one of my Irish ancestors saying that on the boat leaving Ireland. I'd like to give them some credit and imagine that they too dreamed of jerking off in other places.
Mm, yeah, exactly.
That's a new sort of mode of sort of travel writing, you know, the places I have jerked off.
Well, yeah. But honestly, risky long distance migration in human history tends to be a male biased phenomenon. Like, it literally is just dudes going to new places, like doing something. That's very like voluntary long distance migration, almost always elite biased.
You cannot tell me
almost always male biased
that the first person to ever summit Everest, you cannot tell me that the first thing they did wasn't just like, while I'm here.
Yeah.
Oh,
this is something like
a Sherpa. I've got another job for you. Oh, wait, he was from New Zealand, wasn't he? Come here. Sherpa. Would you like to touch my cock? I'm going a bit South African now. That's a different type of guy.
Well, yeah, the South African, frankly, has a lot more practice in sexually exploiting non-Europeans.
Oh, yeah.
I like that. You're really not a lot of elite American men in the South, I would say. Elite Spanish colonizers. Yeah.
Before we get into a slightly dark place, should we do like a quick rundown of what happens in this episode?
I don't know, Phoebe. Yeah. I think 38 minutes in is a bit early for that.
Do some plot points, a little bit of plot.
Yeah, we can do a little bit of plot point. Yeah, episode 5 ended on a cliffhanger with Segestes revealing Arminius's treachery to Varys in the command tent.
Segestes and never beating the little bitch allegations.
No, and throughout this episode, he remains committed to the bit in different ways, which something we can certainly talk about here.
Something we can talk about. Okay, so he shows up. He tells Varys that Arya's going to betray him. And Arminius responds this is a fun one, because it's sort of there's sort of a dramatic irony aspect to it. If you know the story, you know that Arminius succeeds. You know that Varys loses his legions. But you don't know the mechanism by which it succeeds.
One man is particularly very upset by this.
One man in particular
doesn't go down well with his line manager. Let's put it that way.
It doesn't go down well with the middle management of the Roman Empire.
Augustus as middle management is very funny.
Well, the middle management who have to report it to Augustus. They're like going, "No, you tell him. Yeah. I don't want to tell him. You tell him. I don't want to tell him."
There are three freedmen sitting around or enslaved people sitting around their equivalent of desks in the mail room, being like, okay, who's taking this one upstairs? That's almost certainly a thing that happened, which is very funny to think about.
Okay. We're never going to agree. So rock, paper, scissors, rock, paper, what are scissors? What's he talking about?
You're gonna make a writing medium from what now? This is just nonsense.
Okay, pal. Hear him. Do you hear Clodius over here? You know what he's gonna do? He reckons that you can write on a tree. Dickhead.
Not even tree bark. It takes pulp.
You're gonna chew up a tree and then you're gonna write on it. You're gonna make rags to make paper. Like some kind of Egyptian. Come on, man.
Yeah.
Again, hilarious conversation to imagine.
We write on wax like real men.
Yeah.
So I was doing some more research on this recently, and one of the things I learned, which I don't think I had fully internalized, was how much of the actual central administration of the Roman Empire, especially in this period when it's Augustus and he's like kind of, you know, laying institutional foundations, how much of that was handled by enslaved people and free and former imperial slaves, so imperial freedmen. Like the entire central bureaucracy of the Roman Empire, to the extent that there was one, was like 300 guys who Augustus either owned or had owned in the past who remained bound to him. Like, and that was who did all of that work. That was the guy who got the letter that said that Varus's legions had been destroyed and had to figure out how to run the news upstairs. Like, that is a historical guy who existed.
Yeah, that is a terrible Microsoft Teams notification to get. fuck me. Yeah.
Slack was blowing up in the among the imperial freedmen that day.
Yeah. Oh, I fucking hate the calends of the month. People are just dumping shit on your desk.
I mean, like while we're doing modern parallels, there's something of like the Musk about that, like installing people who he like, who specifically work for him, who are like totally loyal to him. They're loyal to him as a guy. They're not loyal to any particular kind of company or institution. They owe everything to this one specific man and therefore can be trusted by him on a clerical and administrative level.
Mm.
So there's it goes even further than that. So because of the way that the ancient people in general, Romans included, tended to think about work, the idea of working for another person was inherently degrading. Mm. And in fact, in a business sense, one free person could not represent another free person in a transaction. Like you could not be like a legal proxy for another free person. Mm. Slaves could.
Well, you did represent another dude.
Yeah, they literally did not believe, as a matter of principle, that was a thing that you could do. Your separate free legal personhoods did not mesh in a way that would allow you to conduct a business transaction for someone else, unless you were a son, right? Because then you're under the you are still to some degree under the legal authority of your father. So these like what we think of as very kind of materially important positions and politically important positions end up being filled by slaves or freedmen because they can act in a legal sense as proxies for their master. So it makes sense administratively to staff for that to be your staff because they are legally inseparable. And even more interesting, I think, is that this is not an Augustan innovation. It's just continuing the practice of Roman aristocratic households for centuries before that. Mm. Like that, especially among the enslaved people that we know from the ancient world, this stratum is massively overrepresented in monuments because they were prosperous enough. They were quite often freed, and they were organized into kind of professional organizations and retained connections to one another. So there are a whole bunch of like mausolea in Rome that belong to that house the remains of all of the enslaved administrators who belonged to a certain person, like the imperial, the one for the imperial freedmen, I think at least in part survives.
That's not only is that super interesting, but second, you know, there are some words which are just like bong rip words. You just feel like someone's just taken just a huge, just does a massive honk before they say it. And I feel like mausolea is one of them. You get to use the plural so, so rarely. So you've got to just do it's proper kind of like, mausolea.
Yeah, no, I it's not a coincidence that I had ripped the Benjamin not a long time before busting out. Like I could tell earlier in my monologue that I was going to get to use mausolea, and I'm like,
that hits real smooth. That's like it's like being in a Scythian hotbox.
A rare plural. Of a Latin loan word. How often do you get to do that?
So rarely. I was going to say something about this, but I can't remember what it was. So we can just move on. Also all of these legal representatives causing a massive headache for Carol from HR, from Senate HR. It's like, look, we're trying to get them to fill in the forms. I'm not sure he's got the capacity to fill in these forms.
Karenia from HR.
Yeah, Karenia from HR. And we need him to fill in these forms because otherwise how are we going to sign him up for the office fun run?
What do you mean you scraped the wax tablet? What do you mean? that was important. We needed to keep that.
Oh, you know what? We're going to have to get a tempin to organize all these tablets. So I don't know where anything is. The last person who worked here
remembers everything for me is off sick.
that's a guy that they had. They had a Greek guy whose job was to remember things. Like if you were an elite Roman, you just outsourced so much of the business of being alive to a coterie of enslaved people who were around you at all times that you didn't actually think of as being fully human in the same way that you were. So they thought of them for the most part as animate tools.
And so
if you're
so today your wife's birthday is the 8th of November. Also you need the Silphium from the shop, but you have the Scythians are coming later. Also there is the report to do about the legions. Okay, thank you. I'm very not well, so I'm going back to bed now.
So when we're trying to understand the character of Varys in this show, right? And like, if we want to take that guy who did exist seriously as a person and understand how he interacted with the world and what it is precisely that makes him a villain too. I thought this was really interesting. This is the guy that Varys is. Varys from childhood has been surrounded by people that he or his family own, right? That he tells them what to do and they do it and they are tools. If we want to actually understand Rome and how it functioned and why they did the things that they did and what the broader impacts of this were, then you have to internalize that guy existed and he believed those things and that was his experience of the world.
I mean, like going even further, it wouldn't have occurred to him to believe anything else.
Yeah.
He had no mechanism by which to believe anything else.
Yeah. Mm. And it's important to understand about the ancient world. There is no abolitionist literature that survives.
Yeah.
Like there were people who held varying degrees of views about the personhood of enslaved people and about how they should be treated, usually for reasons of improving their performance. But that this was how people understood things. This was the world that they lived in. Like these viewpoints were real. They had them. They believed them just as strongly as we believe the things that we believe. And that if that's true, then think about the implications of that for how they treated other people. It's one of the things that's truly horrifying about the ancient world, and that helps us understand why empire is monstrous in general, why the Roman Empire was monstrous in its way, whatever the long-term benefits, like it was still a monstrous thing full of people who repeatedly made the decision to do monstrous things. And like, I think it's worth internalizing that.
Yeah, Absolutely. And it also massively gives the lie to anybody who likes to kind of harp on about the kind of the gentleness and thoughtfulness of the meditations, because you can't get around the violent cultural and social bedrock that underpinned absolutely everything every single Roman citizen believed.
Even with Marcus Aurelius in particular, go look at the column of Marcus Aurelius, look at the scenes that are depicted on it.
Yeah.
And, you know, ripping people away from their homes and burning their homes.
It's super interesting, Marcus Aurelius's column, because it's like an uncensored version of Trajan's column, because it's much less sanitized and much more violent and much more hideous, and it's just around the corner, and it's a much more interesting.
Trajan had a community manager who gave it a once over.
Carol from HR has spoken to Trajan about some inappropriate imagery on his column, and that'll be gone by Monday.
Don't worry. Think we can say that. I think it won't go over very well.
It reflects the kind of underlying fragilities in the Roman psyche that at a time when things were going worse under Marcus Aurelius, like Marcus Aurelius gets all this credit for being one of the last of the great emperors. His reign was not that great. Lots of terrible, bad things happened, like to the extent that we can start talking about the decline of the very, very peak of Roman power. It begins under Marcus Aurelius. And like he bears responsibility for that.
Yeah.
He was
the emperor. It's not just like, oh, well, yeah. I inherited a really complicated. No, you didn't. No, you didn't, man.
The denarius stops with you, mate.
The denarius stops with you.
Truman could never.
So, going back to what we were saying, it's quite tricky to create peril when you're depicting historical events, because we do know that Arminius succeeds. So we don't know how Arminius is going to get out of this confrontation with Varus and being snaked by Mr. Snake Man. But we do know that he does. We just don't know how. And what he does do is he takes a calculated risk based on. One of the things we talked about was Arminius's hurt when he discovers that Varus never really saw him as a Roman son. He saw him as a kind of barbarian ward who he was going to make use of and then expel him and then send him back to where he came from. But in these early scenes of this episode, we understand that Arminius takes the gamble that Varus still loves and respects him, or certainly loves and respects him more than Segestes. And so what he does, he takes a huge risk, which is he describes his exact plan, but like it's a joke, and says, "Oh, so what you think I'm gonna unite the disparate barbarian tribes who hate each other and never fight together ever, and you think we're gonna set up some kind of ambush in the woods, what, against your legions, and that I've been betraying you all along and feeding your movements back because my true loyalty is to my barbarian tribesmen? Is that what I'm doing?
Arminius discovers the power of gaslighting.
Yeah,
repeating back what you're actually doing in an incredulous voice and being like, "You sound crazy right now. That's what you sound like saying that I'm doing that.
Do you want to check my tablet? Look, I'm giving you my tablet. You can check it. You can look at it. No, I'm not waving it around so you can't actually see it. You can. I am an open book. What's a book?
Yeah.
Doesn't matter.
That, so You're absolutely right, Phoebe. I love you pointed out the dynamic because we as the viewers know he is going to get out, right? Like, or at least most of us do. But how he goes about getting out of that is the show's job to figure out, and it's their job to like make that consonant with the overall tone, flow, and thematic content of the show. And the way they do that, it's brilliant because it perfectly illustrates Varys's flaw as a character, Varys's flaw is his arrogance, right? It's that he underestimates the barbarians and he views Roman culture as so superior. Distilled down to its essence, that's Varys's flaw.
Yeah. It's his arrogance as well. His arrogance, yeah, at assuming that no one could possibly come up with a good enough plan to best him. Is going to lead him straight into the trap. And you sort of feel a bit bad for Sagestius at this point. He's like, that's what he's doing. And Varys is like, why don't you fuck off? Why don't you fuck off back to where you came from, you horrible little lowly snake man? Why don't you go crawling off on your belly? Why don't you go do your no arm, no leg wiggling and just go back to where you wriggled on out of.
Sorry, you've come here and now you're slagging off me, son. All right, are you mugging me off, mate? I just don't understand why you think it would be appropriate, right? Come into me fucking tent, all right? You've come into me, Castra, and you're slagging off me, son.
My boys are my world. Yeah. And if you've got a problem with them, you've got a problem with me.
He's
Sunshine.
He's a lovely lad, all right?
He's a lovely boy, no trouble at home.
And he might be adopted, but we don't use that word in this house, all right?
He's our miracle baby. He's our miracle boy. Aren't you, Harry?
That's right.
Middle class.
Harry's
Roman
just this like kind of lumbering
German boy.
Individual. Yeah, that's right, Mum. I'm your miracle baby.
Oh my god.
I'm your Bambino Miraculum.
We have in the past discussed the character of a rather dim-witted day laborer who lives on the Aventine, who is just the Roman version of Mother's special boy. And I feel like there's a lot that we could do with that character if we really wanted to.
I'm making a note of this. It's going alongside Roman Smoking Corner, Roman taxi driver, who doesn't believe that Caesar was stabbed, guy who believes Caesar was stabbed but not by who we think he was stabbed by, and of course Roman HR.
Were there Caesar assassination truthers? There have to have been, right?
So this is what I'm gearing up to developing into something. The assassination truth is, you see this guy, someone believes the official narrative about the Ides of March.
daggers don't melt dictators. We know this. that's not how that works.
I don't, because I'm not a sheep. What's a sheep?
Where were the lictors? Where were the lictors? I have to know why weren't the lictors there? Well,
the lictors got an email that morning telling them not to come to work.
There had to have been a second knifeman. What are you talking about? There were like 15 of them. There was a 16th knifeman, but his alarm didn't go off, so he wasn't there.
Yeah,
he missed the assassination of Caesar because he slept in. All right, what I want to know is why none of those assassins were taught how to land a knife.
Yeah, they were taught to put the knife in, but they weren't taught to put it out.
They weren't taught how to take it out. Why not?
That knife school on the Aventine has a lot of questions to answer.
Look, why were they renting flats in the Insula the day before the Ides of March?
Yeah. Why was the Parthian government paying for their knife lessons? You know, these are all good questions.
Why were the rest of the Brutus family, why were they all like taken out of Rome overnight in special secret carriages?
A lot of questions. A lot of questions that need answer.
Questions.
I mean, I don't know. Have you even seen the Zapruder mosaic? Have you even seen what it can show you?
Like, guy, you just happened to be doing a mosaic outside the Senate when the
hastily arranging colored tiles of stone.
Yeah, frantically putting the tiles down.
More red. I need more red.
Oh my god. Looking at it afterwards, just being like, oh, you forgot to put in the floor stone. Oh, gods are not going to be happy with you, Roman Zapruder.
Doing a mosaic under time pressure is such a like Japanese game show concept. Never try and mosaic a moving target. It's a very difficult enterprise.
Look, can you tell your dictator to sit bloody still? Because I'm having a lot of trouble getting the expressions here.
I know they're stabbing him, but if you want a mosaic of it, they're going to have to hold still a bit. I'm sorry, I'm not a miracle worker here.
Otherwise, this bit's going to be blurred. There's nothing you can do about it. This bit is going to be blurred.
Look, it's a mosaic. It's inherently pixelated. I understand.
But... the most skilled craftsman in the world could not unblur this image. There we go. That's Roman Zapruder. There we go. We've done it. Yep. We've done it, lads.
Gregorius Zaprudus, Roman mosaic artist. And later, inventor of the calendar. This might be the stupidest bit we've ever done on this fucking podcast.
You know, okay, first of all, I don't think you're giving our past selves nearly enough credit.
True. For, right. Recency bias.
Yeah. I'd say, first of all, like, let's give our past selves our flowers for having come up with stupid bits before. But yeah, much to ponder here.
You know, until quite recently, because I'd never heard anyone use the expression recency bias, I'd only ever seen it written down. And for some reason, I have always read it as Regency bias, and I've never questioned this. I've always understood it to mean what it means, but I just kept thinking, yeah, Regency bias.
Regency Everyone's bias, got huge where like, whatever white you wigs. See, you're like, it's not as good as Brighton Pavilion.
Yeah.
It's not as you good as what? Being too fat for your little waistcoat.
You know what my problem is? I don't see nearly enough little colonnaded porches. Can we stick a little colonnade on that? Like a kind
you know
of
what's
yeah,
really
kind of mid-90s
good,
Dutch DJ.
That makes
you don't know
you
what
insane.
You're doing. Just stick a colonnade on it. Put a donk on it.
That's right.
That's my impression of a Dutch DJ, by the way. Just in case that was not clear.
The Blackout Crew. Nobody knows they were Dutch.
Put a colonnade on it. You see this? You see this roof? It's too much like a triangle. Can we put some steps on it? That's the Dutch DJ inventing the gable. Right. Yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
Varys then apologizes to Ari for doubting him, and he does look a bit uncomfortable because he's a bit like, oh. Oh no, that's created some internal conflict there for me. So Ari then sees Ferquin, who is in the kind of cage, in the kind of sort of cage in the slave market bit. They have a kind of conversation where they make a plan while pretending not to, like Arminius kind of turns around and is kind of talking to him. Now, I feel like this is a little bit of a plot hole because it's really obvious that he's talking to him. Because just because he's not looking at him, it doesn't change the fact that he is speaking in his Germanic language and the guy behind him is clearly answering. Like, this is not subtle at all. Anyone looking at them would be like, you two are clearly talking to each other. You're just not looking at each other. How stupid do you think we are? So that's a little bit of a plot hole. But anyway, Then we cut to Thisnelda, who is praying to be given the sight, the gift of sight. She says, I'll sacrifice anything. And this is a little bit of a callback to Folquin saying that he'll sacrifice anything, he'll sacrifice his firstborn. And you are starting to get at this point a little bit of a sense of foreboding, a little bit of a, I'm not sure what the contraceptive arrangements were for in the Tutoboad Forest.
It's a bad time to be a firstborn.
It's a bad time to be a firstborn. You want to be the thirdborn, then like no one's trying to sacrifice you. But
people say eldest children have it rough now, but
yeah, but you know, back in those days,
you weren't subject to divine. You're not subject to divine punishment for your parents' sins.
Tell me you were the eldest daughter without telling me. Oh, my mother promised to sacrifice me before I was born.
Yeah. My father sacrificed me for an auspicious voyage to Troy. yeah, no one to just oldest daughter things.
Just oldest daughter things.
.tumblr.com.
Yeah, that's right. So she says I'll sacrifice anything. I feel like people are being a little bit too fast and loose with the I'll sacrifice anything in this show. But then the nasty Reek, the Reek of the Chatty, he shows up. He tries to do his best sarging on her. And then he remembers that he is a barbarian Reek in the first century and is like, oh, I could just rape you. I don't have to convince you. I could just do that. She fights him off and like tries to like stab him in the neck. Now, I think this is another little plot hole. Pat and I talked about this a little bit about the representation of women. We come to the conclusion, which I think is a fair one, which is you basically have to just do some suspension of disbelief when it comes to women in the ancient world in TV shows that represent the ancient world, because if you have any kind of formal accuracy, it's A, just depressing, and B, you just really can't really have any female characters, because there's no point. There's just no point to having them there.
Puella Domina wasn't invented until later on in antiquity.
Well, exactly. So what my objection is considering that all the other barbarians are like a kind of, you know, kind of noble and egalitarian and everyone must earn their place at the fire and that stuff, apart quite specifically from Thusnelda's mum and dad, who are both pieces of shit in different ways. So who is meant to have taught her to handle herself? Bearing in mind that her parents are trying to like literally kind of sell her off as like bride chattel to like a neighboring guy, who at what point has taught her quite impressive self-defense and martial arts skills? Where is she meant to have picked that up?
So, I mean, I think we're supposed to understand that she's always been interested in that stuff because of when she and Folkvin and Ari fought the wolf early on.
Yeah, I don't really buy it. Like, it doesn't, like, I understand why it's there, but it doesn't really make much sense. That's a little bit, again, suspension of disbelief stuff. So he gets pissed off. He's not happy that this has happened. So he doesn't show up. He doesn't show up to the first day of war. Like, everyone's like, look, the coach can't go until the Reek of the Chatty has shown up.
They operate on a buddy system.
We've got, yeah. If he doesn't show up by 9:30, we're just going to go without him, and then he won't get to go to the British Museum.
he's going to be like, hang on a minute, that's mine.
Wait, hang on.
How did they get that?
Oh, no, the clocks have changed. Mm-hmm. I'll be there in 15 minutes. Anyway, he doesn't show up to the first day of war when everyone's doing
engagement ring.
When everyone's doing their name badges, you know, everyone's like working out where they're going to sit on the coach, etc. He doesn't show up. So the tribesmen are starting to have cold feet. So Thusnelda's very unimpressed by this, and she's got to do something, you know, pretty spectacular in order to persuade them to continue with their plans and to kind of, you know, warm their feet back up, as it were. And so we have like an interesting departure where we move from the narrative basis that this is what these people believe and this is what they are shown to believe, to a more literal representation of this is literally true. They believe it because this is the literal truth of what is going on. So she slashes her eye open and it gives her seeing powers. She's not pretending, she's not doing it for She's not doing it to kind of G up the men. And I do think that is an interesting departure, because there is a difference between we are depicting what these people believe and we are depicting the supernatural, we are depicting the divine. And that is just something that you're supposed to take as the kind of legitimate, kind of truthful context of what's going on. So she kind of makes a kind of funny face after you'd slashed your eye open. With the wolf fang that used to belong to Folquin, and then she goes to the reeks sort of one by one and says, "You will bathe in Roman gold and other such things." Which, say you're a German reek in AD 9, you're gonna want to hear that. You're gonna be like, "This is interesting. Tell me more."
She's kind of like the ancient equivalent of those guys on TikTok who claim they can teach you to make $40,000 a month on Forex trading.
Yeah, she's a...
She's like, sign up to my Telegram channel for more.
She's a Bitcoin millionaire, is Thisnelda. I've just put here bloody hell after she's done that. And that
she's pretty baller.
Yeah, she's really making a display of herself, I've also put here. Then she kind of does herself up like in Mad Max Fury Road, and the ambush succeeds and Arminius shows up. He's got his like Roman helmet and so on, but he takes his helmet off and he's got his like special barbarian face paint. He's stopped off at the zoo to get his face paint done, but it's to show that he's changed sides. Segestes goes off to find the reek of the chatty and suggests a method of bringing down Ari. Like, at this point, you're a bit like, you're just a dickhead. There's no even sort of pragmatic reason for you behaving
he's
like
just
this.
A hater.
You're just a hater. So Ari also lets Thisnelda think that Folquin is dead, even though he knows different. And then we have this is the bit that I didn't like. I found it a bit embarrassing. We have a kind of slow-mo fighting scene with a voiceover over it, which is Ari talking about why we fight and what we fight for. And then it turns out that the voiceover is him addressing the piked head of Varys. The barbarians have done something super cool with like a kind of booby trap, kind of a sort of flaming booby trap in the woods, and that kind of traps the Romans, who will go on fire. I've just put here barbarians' dream house with no context, and I don't know what I meant by this, but there we go. Varys sees what's gone on, understands that his son has betrayed him, and he falls on his sword, which is baller. Also, when Ari sees him doing it, he yells something, and I think this is quite clever. They turn the volume down so you can't hear exactly what he yells, and it could be Varta or it could be Parta, and we don't know which it is. And I think that's smart. I think that's a smart little kind of... Look at the tension. Look at the conflict. We're gonna do that in what a piece of writing. That it portrays so much in just like one bit. This is why I think it's a shame to have the kind of the hackneyed kind of voiceover and why do we fight and the kind of the sort of the cod like philosophizing stuff, because.
So I don't disagree with that, but I'm gonna give it a slightly different cast.
Okay.
And the reason why it worked for me is because of the simple fact of what he's doing. Mm-hmm. He's talking to the severed head of his adopted father, right? Mm-hmm. And I think you put that in context of the post battle scene. The stuff the Germanic tribesmen are doing here is pretty not chill. They're torturing captives. They're hanging people. They're cutting off the testicles of the dead and eating them. And
got to get that protein in.
You got it. Like that's I Can't say that I've ever tried human testicles, but it's spiritual bulking is what it is. Your spirit bulking your masculine spirit.
Jesus hadn't yet died for their gains, so.
No, no. So you got to get all your gains yourself. So I think it puts a rather darker cast on the whole thing.
Yeah, I agree. When you find out what he's doing, like that is like it's like really bleak and really grim. But like I think it's just the wording that feels a little bit kind of like,
yeah. I'm with you. It wouldn't have been the dialogue that I would have put in there. Not that I'm a writer of very good television shows. I appreciated the post-climactic, like the kind of falling action at the very end showed us that the people who won are not necessarily good people either.
I thought that was done well, because we do have this little kind of like reminder, like, oh, you know that what you've got in your head when you hear barbarians, they are going to celebrate their victory a little bit barbarically. But then again, the kind of more sort of brutal efficiency of dispatch that the Romans would have done, were they the victorious ones? The piles of bodies are still the piles of bodies, whatever's gone on in the aftermath. Whether one is worse than the other, I think is potentially a little bit academic. And I think that's a point that the show makes pretty reasonably, particularly since one of the most horrible things that happens in the whole show is the crucifixion of this entire innocent family, which is done by the Romans. So you are certainly not encouraged to think like, oh God, well the Romans wouldn't have done this. You're encouraged to think of it as by its own terms, an incredibly violent time. And the expression and manifestation of that violence depends on your social and cultural context, but violence is violence.
Yep.
And lack of respect for the dead is lack of respect for the dead.
From the very beginning, this show, I feel like, set out to say something bleak, but also interesting in terms of like digging into the depths of the conflicts that rage within the soul, a conflicted soul.
Yeah.
Right. Like they did some really cool, really interesting things with that. But its overall viewpoint is pretty bleak. And I honestly don't think that's a bad way to understand the ancient world. Mm. Like most talk of human progress is kind of bullshit. Right. But there is an extent to which in the ancient world, people really did live on a day-to-day basis with a much more real fear of somebody coming to kill them, take their stuff, enslave them, otherwise immiserate them. Like that was an experience that was far more widespread in the ancient world. Yeah. And even the citizens of prosperous places and like powerful empires still feared that outcome because they knew it could happen, because it did happen.
Yeah. The closest we get now is the TV licensing man.
Right. Yeah, we just like generally don't have to worry as much about that. And like when shows lean into that and try to understand the precise ways in which that was bleak. Mm. Like not just that it's kind of like I couldn't help but watch this show as a counterpoint to Those About to Die, because we watched it so recently, right? And that show is bleak for the sake of shock value and for kind of being bleak as a kind of a faux cool, faux sophisticated way of understanding the world. Mm-hmm. This show is bleak because the ancient world was bleak in a very specific set of ways.
Yeah.
And that by accurately portraying those bleak things, you can make a really rich and rewarding experience for the viewer. So I appreciated that about this show.
Yeah, yeah, no, I absolutely agree with you. So just okay, we're running to time, so just like last few bits of notes. So it is Segestes that clatters the head off Varys after he falls on his sword. So he presumably he's changed sides again because he does this kind of like he kind of shouts for victory. It's incredible that no one's like, well, hang on a fucking minute, Segestes, whose side are you on now? Have you filled in your forms with Karenia to indicate that you have changed sides? Mm-hmm. So Thisnelda tells Arminius that she knows that he lied about Folkwyn being dead, but she's okay with it because he's going to be the king and she's going to be his queen. So an interesting moral compass there. Then Arya approaches Folkwyn and is like, hey, let's be friends. And Folkwyn's like, I'll kill you. So that's being set up as a bit of conflict for the next series. Then Thisnelda gets told by the shaman that she is up the stick and that it's not her husband's. And then you're like, oh no, remember what he said about sacrificing his firstborn? And remember what she said about how she's going to sacrifice anything in return for being a seer? Oh no, oh no. And the shaman says the gods have a special way of punishing us all, which feels a little bit unreasonable given that she is like the primary architect of this incredible victory that they have just won. But whatever. Then Arya sees a wolf. Again, semiotically, we are not clear what this wolf is. Who is this wolf? Who is this wolf meant to be? Is it just a nice big dog that's just like shown up like, ha, hello, woof, woof, woof. We don't know, but that is the end of the series, and that is the end of the first series of Barbarians.
Yeah. Yeah. That's I appreciate that they kind of end on those ambiguous things, because people in this show seem to really believe the things that they believe. They act in ways that are in accordance with their principles. And that takes them to really interesting places. And I think like when the characters believe in their frameworks and they follow those beliefs to their logical conclusions, you get a sense for the kind of constructedness of human experience where like these things are true because they believe they're true. They believe they're true. Therefore they're true. Like it all kind of we viewing this from the outside can see the kind of constructedness of their experience in a way that reflects our own.
I enjoyed it. It was like,
it was
fun to watch something that didn't suck.
Yeah. Yeah. Here's hoping the next thing we watch doesn't suck.
Fingers crossed.
So in that vein, we are, I believe next week we are starting, Mrs. Brown's Boys Rome. So fingers crossed for that being something that doesn't suck.
Yeah.
I just realized, Pat, that you have no idea what Mrs. Brown's Boys is.
I do not know. I was completely lost.
It's an unfunny TV show beloved by the British people. Yeah.
The Poirot of Mrs. Brown.
Maita Brown.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for listening to this. This has been a free one, I think.
I think so.
If you're a free listener and you want to catch up on the episodes you missed, there's the Patreon. It's $5 a month. You get twice as much of this. It really is that simple.
Mathematically,
I can't stress enough. It really is that simple.
It is low effort for you.
Yeah. Do you want twice as much of fucking
this,
you know, Gregorius Zaprudus, Roman mosaicist and witness of Caesar's assassination?
I love the idea of this guy.
Yeah, perfect. a character who'll be rattling around in my head for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, if you're in Ireland, please come and see me on tour in early June. milowebbles.co.uk/live-shows. Cheers. All right. We'll see you next time.
Bye. Bye.